Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is former Ag Secretary Dan Glickman, who joins us to offer his thoughts on debt ceiling deliberations and the upcoming Farm Bill. But first, here's this week's headlines. Big spending cuts for the Department of Agriculture are a feature of the first draft spending bill rolled out by House Republican appropriators. The bill would cut USDA's funding for the 2024 fiscal year by one-third. House Democrats say the cuts would produce the lowest spending level since 2006. The GOP proposal is $11.7 billion below what President Joe Biden requested earlier this year. If passed, the bill would also restrict Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack's use of the Commodity Credit Corporation, something Ag Appropriations Subcommittee Chair Andy Harris said on this program was one of his priorities. Senate appropriators have not yet released their companion measure to fund the department. The Black Sea Grain Initiative will continue for another 2 months. Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and the United Nations have been working to resolve a disagreement over the original extension agreed upon in March. Now the deal is set to remain in effect through mid-July. According to the initiative's Joint Coordination Center, Ukraine was able to export more than 25 million metric tons of wheat, corn, and other commodities during the first two terms of the initiative to 45 countries. And finally, negotiations to raise the nation's borrowing authority made progress this week, but all sides of the deliberation say plenty of work remains to produce an agreement. President Biden is headed to the G7 summit, but told reporters Wednesday he expects talks will continue in his absence by officials he's appointed to talk through the deal's specifics. He also said he was willing to debate possible changes to work requirements, but not if they go much beyond what is already on the books. Dan Glickman was the nation's agriculture secretary during much of the Clinton administration, giving him a front-row seat to the changes produced through the 1996 welfare reform debate. To start our conversation, we asked him how those changes impacted the department and the people it served.
Well, in 96, President Clinton wanted to make a deal with the then Speaker Gingrich about a lot of things, and Gingrich had taken his leadership as Speaker of the House, and so he worked a deal where welfare reform passed. It was actually in a separate piece of legislation. It wasn't part of the Farm Bill itself, but it did have some work requirements in it, and they were fairly reasonable. But it was all part of the legislative process. It was all part of an actual bill that was going to the House. The problem with this debt ceiling is, by and large, the Republicans want to add a whole bunch of substantive provisions to a debt ceiling bill where there have been no hearings, no legislative discussion of these kinds of things. It's an inappropriate place to do that. It's not inappropriate to deal with it in a farm bill setting, because some of the concerns may be legitimate, but not just to hold up the payment of American debt to all the debt holders of our country, which could really drive this country into a serious financial situation.
One of the proposals on the table, both kind of in a farm bill context and a debt ceiling context, is changing the age for the able-bodied adults without dependent provision, raising that to 55 from the current 49. In your thoughts, what would that ultimately mean for SNAP?
You know, first of all, it has almost an infinitesimal impact on cost. It's an ideological thing. I think there's some reason to look at our work requirements to see if the talent pool, the work pool needs to be adjusted. But it's a serious legislative change. It doesn't belong in a debt ceiling bill. It has nothing to do with the debt ceiling. Can you imagine if people on the Democratic side wanted to change computation of the price coverage of crop insurance, for example, in the debt ceiling bill because they felt it was too expensive? Can you imagine the outrage that would take place in that? Well, that's kind of what the progressives are saying in this piece of legislation. Do it in the normal course of legislative business. We got to pay our debts. We got to pay our bondholders, and the country has to go forward. So I think that it's inappropriate, but let's hope that it gets worked out in the short term.
I want to shift a little bit and talk about the Farm Bill, because obviously we're getting closer and closer to September 30th all the time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, sort of the official expiration. There's many programs that will continue functioning after that. But as we get closer and closer to that date, I mean, what do you kind of assess as the current state of those talks, given the fact that we are getting closer to that end date?
I'd say it's 50-50. I hope we get a farm bill this year. I think the uncertainty is never very good. Although if we had to extend it 1 year, it wouldn't be the end of the world either. I mean, people could live with the provisions. I'm hopefully they'll be able to get it done. If this debt ceiling's not resolved, we won't get it done, I promise you. If we go into some sort of default, there will be no farm bill. There may be no Social Security or Medicare as well, but there will be no farm bill. But I think from a bipartisan perspective, most people want to see us to get this done this year.
We'll have more from former Secretary Glickman right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. Former Ag Secretary Dan Glickman says a House Republican efforts to restrict the Ag Secretary's Commodity Credit Corporation spending authority would have hampered his ability to use the account.
It would mean that we couldn't do emergencies very easily. So maybe another country overseas needed our grain on an emergency basis. I could always come in and dip into the CCC. I wouldn't call it my little slush fund, but it was a very nice way to deal with urgent, unanticipated things that would happen with respect to overseas commitments, with natural disasters that would affect farmers and ranchers all over the country. So the more restrictions you put on that CCC funding, the less flexible the USDA would be in dealing with these problems.
You were, of course, involved in the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research and still are involved. That program created in the 14 Farm Bill and right. Has funded so much agriculture research across the country. Big debate right now going on over the future of research funding. Should it be mandatory versus discretionary? Should we increase the amount in this Farm Bill process? Your thoughts as someone who's kind of been up close and personal with research funding?
We need to increase the amount of money in research. The Chinese and Brazilians are actually spending much more than we are, and it's particularly on a per capita basis. We have so many issues regarding climate, regarding productivity, regarding pests and disease of animals and plants, feeding a hungry world, water resources. There's just enormous amount of problems affecting agriculture, both at home and around the world. And research is one way to deal with this over the longer term basis. You know, in terms of what percentage goes into discretionary versus goes into mandatory, that's a question Congress is going to have to decide. But there needs to be a predictable supply of funds for both the land grant schools, for organizations like FAR that I've been involved with, and for the private sector to be dealing with this area. There's nothing more important to the future of agriculture than an adequate research budget.
I want to ask you about crop insurance, because when you were secretary, Congress obviously instituted some reforms to that program, and there's been big growth in the crop insurance program since then. But now we see, headed into this Farm Bill reauthorization process, some discussion about, maybe making a permanent disaster program. There's a lot of ad hoc disaster programs that are passed on a year-to-year basis, after certain disasters. What do you make of some of the current discussion and some of the ad hoc bills that we're seeing?
You know, what goes around comes around, Spencer. So I've always been against permanent disaster programs, but then we have a disaster, so we create a new disaster program to deal with that particular disaster that hits it. But risk management and crop insurance needs to be the way we go. We've done a very good job. The department's done a good job of implementing those programs. They're still not as good as they should be for specialty crop producers, particularly for, vegetables and fruit growers, not just in the West Coast, but everywhere. There's great opportunities to grow specialty crops in heartland corn, soybean country, wheat country. But the crop insurance program has not been terribly suitable to those producers, so they haven't diversified the crops as much as they should. So there are a lot of reforms that we can continue to make there.
I want to wrap up our interview asking about the loss of someone that you knew well over the years in farm policy. Charlie Senholm passed away this week. When you think about the work that he did here in Washington, the impact on farm policy, what do you think is ultimately the legacy of a guy like Charlie Senholm?
Charlie was solid, honest. People loved him on both sides of the aisle. He was true to his vision about needing to control the federal deficit, even if that impacted agriculture. Charlie called him as he saw him. He wasn't just out to put his finger up in the air and figure out what necessarily people wanted out there, but he wanted to do the right thing. He was, I think, if Jefferson and Hamilton and the founding fathers had in mind what kind of member of Congress they would want to represent this country, Charlie Stenholm would fit that model. When I was secretary, Charlie would not be shy telling me, Dan, that's not how the way the cotton program works. Dan, you need to come down here and see the relationship between soybeans and corn and cotton. But he was gentle and kind when he would say that. He was not vicious. He was not bitter. He was not partisan. Charlie is this kind of person we need more of like in our political system, particularly in Congress. He was had strong views, but he wasn't a polarizing personality. He wasn't trying to destroy the other side of the aisle. It's the kind of person that I'd like to see more of. I will miss him.
Very much. Very many people will miss Charlie Stenholm. We certainly join the family in mourning that loss. But Secretary Glickman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel has a look at changes in government support for producers in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Direct government payments to producers are expected to continue decreasing this year after reaching record highs just a few years ago. This chart shows direct government payments to American producers from 2014 through projected totals for the 2023 fiscal year. According to USDA, payments reached a record high of $45.6 billion in fiscal year 2020. But as you can see, payments have decreased since then. Several factors played into the increase of government payments at the end of the last decade, including the Trump administration's market facilitation program, as well as the coronavirus food assistance program. Payments are forecast to be just over $10 billion in fiscal year 2023, a decrease of more than $35 billion in 3 years. Experts point to lower anticipated payments from supplemental and ad hoc disaster assistance programs as driving factors behind the expected decrease. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Who's the number one protein source in chicken feed? You are. Who just increased sales to Egypt by 700%? You did. Who made a huge deal with Goodyear? You again. Take a victory lap. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff. Moving soy forward. Moving you forward.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're going to talk with a couple of food companies in their interest in the upcoming farm bill. Talk so much about the producer perspective. Let's hear the other side of that coin headed into this upcoming reauthorization. Joined by Adam Wortheson with Organic Valley, as well as Christine Cochran with Snack International. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Christine, I want to go to you first because, you know, obviously, as I mentioned, we talk so much about what the farm bill means for the nation's producers, but wondering, what does the legislation mean for your organization and its members?
The nutrition title in the Farm Bill is incredibly important. It's important to food companies, but it's also really important to sustaining our communities and helping those who are less fortunate. So here at Snack International, we really focus in on supporting the hunger groups in their efforts to preserve SNAP choice. And for those who don't know, SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that comes, we expect it to come in this year at around $145 billion, as we have over 42 million people currently receiving those benefits.
So obviously, you know, we look at that $145 billion figure that you mentioned there. That comes from last week's, the recent Congressional Budget Office scoring on the Farm Bill baseline. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program obviously gets quite a bit of that Farm Bill funding. But I wonder, as we look at that figure growing more, they also said a million more people were going to be added to the program's rolls. What do you think that means for the Farm Bill and as well as for your organization, those bigger projections that we saw from CBO?
Well, one of the things to remember about SNAP is that it ebbs and flows with our economic situation. So what we see is SNAP beneficiaries receiving those benefits during moments of crisis, whether that is economic, right? So for example, in COVID-19, we saw an enormous increase in the number of people on the roster between 2019 and 2020. But we also see increases in participation when there are natural disasters. So in 2021, the year we have the most recent data, 17 different states had increases in SNAP participation due to disaster relief. So it's a real program that steps in and is a safety net in moments of need. So we believe strongly in being there for people, especially when we're talking about food. I think it's really critical, whether it's economic or natural disasters that create the situation, we want to make sure that we preserve that safety net for Americans.
Good deal. And Adam, I want to bring you into the fold. And before we talk about some of the Farm Bill discussion that we might be having or might be seeing from the organic sector in this upcoming reauthorization, I want to kind of frame up that that discussion with a broader question. Talking about Organic Valley, obviously a company very familiar to many people walking through the nation's grocery stores, producing so many of the dairy products, the organic dairy products that are being sold there. But I wonder, as you get through the production process to produce those dairy products, can you talk to us about the amount of livestock feed that you have available to produce some of these organic dairy products? Do you have a good quantity, or would you like to see perhaps the government step in and further incentivize additional organic feedstock for you?
You know, organic feedstuffs over the last 2 years has been a real challenge for producers. We've seen, at least on the dairy side, probably an increased cost of $300 million. Between 2019 and 20 compared to 21 and 22. The whole organic sector probably saw about an $800 million cost increase. And those costs to increase on feedstuffs really came from two things that happened. One was the war in Ukraine, and second had to do with the international trade dispute with India. And people might ask the question, well, why would those two things matter? Well, a lot of the feedstuffs that is organic is imported. The question you have really about, is there a need to bring in more acres? We think yes. The driver should be really the economic opportunity, and that farmers that want to bring in acres and capture that premium. You know, we want a demand side driven motivation versus sort of a supply-side driven motivation.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. Adam Wortheson says the upcoming Farm Bill is going to be key to Organic Valley, and there are many priorities they hope to achieve during reauthorization.
We've really kind of centered on, I would say, two different areas. One is really about how do we help our farmer base become more resilient on the farm. So that's everything from how do we incentivize renewable energy investments. You know, I believe every organic dairy farm should have solar on it if they want to have solar on it to, you know, make themselves more self, resilient and be able to have energy production that they're not drawn from the grid. Outside of sort of those kind of self-resilience pieces, we are looking at what are the investments like the Dairy Business Innovation Initiative, which really helps strengthen the supply chain to be able to get product to market and be able to have, you know, the right size processing capacity for the industry. Beyond that, we are looking at some of the organic transition pieces and organic research pieces in particular, you know, organics has a particular need for in production. They don't have some of the same tools that are in, you know, conventional agriculture. So how do we resource the research agenda for organic?
Well, I want to wrap up our conversation with you, Adam, and before I shift back to Christine, asking about kind of a non-farm bill issue. Obviously, so much discussion in the dairy industry right now on federal milk marketing order reform. And I want to ask you, you know, obviously we haven't seen the finality of how USDA is going to approach this. A lot of things still yet to be determined there. But I do wonder, based on your read of the situation, do you anticipate that everything, the industry, both the producers, the processors, the organic, the conventional, all sides of this, do you think the issues are going to be able to be worked out within the USDA system, or, you know, that USDA reform system, or do you anticipate potentially some farm bill conversation will be needed to achieve some of these policy changes sought by industry at this point?
Yeah, that's loaded. The federal market order conversation right now is really animated, right? There's been three petitions submitted to USDA, and there has been some legislation that's been circulating, you know, looking at some of those pieces. I guess our perspective as Organic Valley is we really do think that the dairy economists and professionals at the department is the right place for this to be had. We're looking forward to that USDA hearing process. I know they're marching forward with consideration there, and we're going to be bringing proposals and ideas that invigorate sort of fluid milk and class one investment, and, you know, that bring some greater equity and fairness to the federal milk marketing orders.
Very good. Well, wrapping up our conversation then with you, Christine, and looking at kind of a non-farm bill issue, because obviously the COVID-19 pandemic was such a shock to the system for so many different people in so many different ways, including the supply chains that we saw across the economy, you know, had so many different impacts, the multifaceted changes that were forced upon many different industries. And I wonder, as you look at your members and your industry, how has that supply chain dynamic shifted since then? What changes can you observe at this point as a result of some of the onsets of the COVID-19 pandemic?
What I'd say we see now is continued pressure, especially on the ingredient side, as food inflation persists and the real cost of food continues to be high. I think as an industry, one of the other things that we have done is since 2020, you know, we've learned a lot through various iterations. And so what we see are companies implementing supply chain management techniques that are very sophisticated and very timely in order to not only manage the current situation, but project and adapt and be flexible depending on what we see coming our way.
Very good. Well, obviously so many different dynamics out there for so many different companies and industries. It's a fascinating part of farm policy, but that farm and food policy obviously traveling together in the same piece of reauthorized legislation here before too long in this upcoming farm bill. We appreciate both of you stopping by to tell us a little bit more about what that might look like. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pegel has the next part of our Farm Bill Focus.
Title IX of the Farm Bill is focused on energy, including the development of biofuels and other renewable energy systems, which are administered by the Department of Agriculture. Some of the programs that fall under this title include the Bio-Based Markets Program, the Rural Energy for America Program, most commonly known as REAP, the Rural Energy Savings Program, and many more. These programs incentivize research, development, and the adoption of renewable energy projects, including solar, wind, and anaerobic digesters. The energy title aims to strengthen American energy security, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and increase demand for U.S. farm products. Some of the incentives utilized through this title include steps to encourage the construction of blender pumps that can dispense higher percentages of biofuels and loan guarantees to construct production facilities. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Register now for the 2023 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place on June 5th at the Sheraton Grand Sacramento and through our virtual experience. View the latest information and register today under the events tab at agripulse.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. A House Ag subcommittee will get together Tuesday to hear from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and Farm Service Agency. USDA will release a biannual report on the farm labor workforce and its compensation on Wednesday. We'll have the latest farm policy news throughout the week on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.